You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Milwaukee just achieved unique status for its recreation department. Find out what a national recognition means for Wisconsin's biggest city. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. This year marks the program's 10th anniversary here on WPR. As part of the celebration, we're sharing some of our favorite stories. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about musician Joni Mitchell's time in Madison.
This story brings together a midwinter ice storm, the southeast shore of Lake Mendota in Madison, ice skating, and a series of photographs that became a record album cover. Dean Robbins takes us back in time to a cold February photo session on the bleak, frozen lake.
I remember the 1970s as a time of journeys. College kids like me were forever on the road to discovery, whether hitchhiking or exploring our inner selves. That's why we idolized Joni Mitchell.
I'm traveling in some vehicle. I'm sitting in some cafe.
Like us, this eccentric singer-songwriter was on a quest. We followed her progress from the open-hearted folky of Chelsea Morning to the jaded romantic of Blue to the brash pop star of Help Me. In 1976, Mitchell's wanderlust brought her to Madison in a spontaneous photo shoot on Lake Mendota. Months later, the photographs appeared on an album jacket, encapsulating both Joni's career and the self-analytical post-hippie era she ruled over. Mitchell came to Madison for a February concert at the Dane County Coliseum in the midst of an ice storm. She'd just broken up with her longtime boyfriend and called off the rest of her troubled tour, so her emotional state was melancholy in the extreme. Gazing at frozen Lake Mendota from the Edgewater Hotel, she felt the call of the glassy white void. She could hear tree branches cracking under the weight of the ice, a sound reminiscent of tinkling glass. Mitchell went into town to buy a pair of skates, choosing men's black to match her mournfulness. She donned a long black skirt and a black ermine cape and leaped onto the ice. The surface was dangerously spongy. Freezing cold water splashed onto Joni's face, leaving welts. But she felt compelled to go through with her mad plan. Her photographer followed along to record the strange scene. Mitchell was surprised to find that her cape acted as a sort of sail. She spread her arms and let the wind carry her, looking like a crow in flight. The photographs captured a mystical moment, an artist on an unearthly journey, destination unknown and arrival uncertain. Joni liked the photos so much that she used them for black and white montages on her album Hegira. The title is an Arabic word meaning journey, and the wintry images fit perfectly with the musical message. Chilled by jazz rock guitar, the songs are less melodies than moods. They're less pop than poetry. In Coyote, Amelia, and other meandering masterpieces, Mitchell evokes the restlessness of the road, mirroring the restlessness of her soul. Jaco Pastorius' prodding bass seems like a stand-in for the psychic obsession she can't let go of. Rolling Stone picked Hegira's cover as one of the best ever. But for a Madison resident, it has special meaning. It shows us that frozen Lake Mendota is not just a place for casual recreational activities. It can also be something far more mysterious, an expanse of endless possibility.
You still have your music, and I've still got my eyes on the land and the sky. You sing for your friends and your family. I'll walk green pastures by and by.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, Milwaukee Recreation is getting some national recognition. The Division of Milwaukee Public Schools that oversees community programs and education centers in the district was recognized by the Commission for Accreditation of Park and Recreation Agencies with a nationwide accreditation. Only 2% of parks and rec departments around the country have received that recognition. Milwaukee is just the third here in the state of Wisconsin. Lynn Greb is director of Milwaukee Recreation. I talked to her earlier today about the impact of this accomplishment. Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I'm so happy to be here.
Can you tell us what this accreditation means for you at Milwaukee Recreation and the people you serve?
Well, we're super excited to have been given the designation of the CAPRA accreditation. And for us, it really means that, to me, it validates the work we do for the Milwaukee community. It held us up against 154 standards. We actually met 100% of the standards with the review. And I believe that really solidifies our place as the leading provider of quality recreation for Milwaukee.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of the different facilities and programs you operate there at Milwaukee Recreation?
Well, we like to say that we program in more than 100 locations on an annual basis. But what's unique about our operation is that most of our indoor programming occurs within the Milwaukee Public School facilities. And then we also manage 52 play fields that service our outdoor activities, our playgrounds, our softball leagues, all the basketball, all the things that people like to do outside. And then we have a couple special sites. We actually operate a farm out in Dousman, Wisconsin, Oak Ridge Farm, and that's a partnership we have with the DNR. And we also have a nature center right here in the city of Milwaukee, Hawthorne Glen, which is a beautiful gem located right, like I say, in the heart of Milwaukee.
As I understand it, Milwaukee Rec is the only school district-run agency to get this accreditation. How can you talk about the relationship with the district in running all those programs you just mentioned?
It's really unique to the state of Wisconsin. Back in the early 1900s, the state legislature passed a law that allowed school districts to levy tax dollars for community recreation services. And so a number of schools, districts in the state of Wisconsin have operated this way, and they have their own recreation department that provides programs for their entire community, which is how we're set up in Milwaukee. And I really think that that relationship is not only unique, but very beneficial, especially to the taxpayer, because we make use of existing facilities. We don't have to put all our money into capital and infrastructure. And that way we can pour more of our resources into the actual programming. And that really, I think, is what sets us apart as a department.
Of course, you're in Wisconsin's biggest city. Can you talk about the role of recreation programs like this in an urban setting?
Well, for sure, I mentioned the 52 outdoor spaces that we manage, and I think that's so important for our city to have green spaces, places of respite they can go to and enjoy and benefit from doing outdoor recreation activities. Also, just the alone with the after-school programming we do in over 100 locations, providing safe spaces for young people to go after the school day ends or on the weekends and really get that introduction to recreation and the benefits and the things you enjoy doing in your free time. But the fact that we service young people as, you know, infants all the way to senior adults, there's always something for everybody in our community to participate and take advantage of.
Now, you've been jumping through a lot of hoops for this national accreditation, and you've been doing a lot of it during the pandemic. How much of a wrench did that throw in this effort?
Interesting question. I mean, I think the advantage of it is that, unfortunately, a number of our programs had to be scaled back during that period while we switched to more of a virtual mode for our customer. It did give us the opportunity to focus a little more on writing the various responses to the standards we had to meet. So it did allow us to shift a little bit and spend more time, but it really came down to when the deadline was set and we knew we had, you know, the finish line ahead, getting our minds set and focusing, you know, the majority of our time on the process, I think was really going to happen either way, but definitely having a little more of that time available during the pandemic was helpful to the process.
What are your hopes for the kind of services you can provide, maybe expansions or changes or updates you can do over the next few years?
We are really focused on the improvement to our outdoor infrastructure, the play fields that we operate. We have been on since 2016. We did an assessment of all of our 52 play fields and found that over 60% were rated fair to poor. And so we have invested heavily in dollars and resources to work on a plan to revitalize those play spaces. So that is a big focus. The other focus will be for us now is maintaining our accreditation. So we're really going to be putting our energies into a number of the plans that were developed as part of the process and making sure that we're on task with all of the things, you know, we mapped out for us to follow, but also measuring our performance and making sure we're meeting customer satisfaction and delivering a quality product.
Before I let you go, Lynn, could you offer some encouragement to people to get involved with their local recreation department, whether that's Milwaukee or elsewhere in the state, as a volunteer or whatever other kind of help you need?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I'll say as a participant, I think one of the things I really appreciate about community recreation departments is that it gives people that introduction to really a vast number of activities that they can dabble in and see if they like it, and then maybe go to a more advanced activity outside of the department that they're working with. But for us here in Milwaukee, we have hundreds of different activities for people to take advantage of. So if you're just curious about something or want to get, you know, your hands wet into something that, you know, you might enjoy, I think your local recreation department is the place to start.
Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it, Rob.
That was Lynn Grab, Director of Milwaukee Recreation. We talked earlier today about what her department's new national accreditation means for the community. Coming up on Central Time, we want to hear from you with your story of learning a second language, or third, fourth, or fifth language, if you've gone that far. We had a great conversation a while back about America's bilingual century. A lot of you called in. We didn't have time for all your stories, and we've been meaning to come back to it. Now is your chance. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know how you learned a second language. If you're learning one right now, what worked, what didn't, why you did it. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll take your calls. Maybe you can lay on some of that second language for us coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We are looking to hear from you now. Our question is, have you ever learned or tried to learn a second language? Did you grow up learning two languages? Have you learned a third or fourth or a fifth? What did it take? Are you naturally good at languages, do you think, or are you like me? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe you grew up speaking English and learned another language, or maybe English is your second language. Love to hear what worked for you in learning, what some of the weirdest things you encountered along the way were. If you're learning something right now, whether you're in middle school or you're a senior, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A little background. Talked a while back to Steve Levine. He's the author of the book America's Bilingual Century. And he had tried and not done so well with learning languages earlier in his life. Passed up, he said, a lot of great opportunities. Well, he came back to it and got him really interested in collecting the stories of all the different pathways people take to learn a second language. Well, we got a lot of great calls from you with your stories of learning languages at different ages, different places in your lives. And we ran out of time for those calls. And so we've been looking for an opportunity. Here it is to hear more of your stories. You can join in now. The number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I could always use some inspiration and encouragement. Didn't take any foreign languages through high school. Did a lot of German in college. Not much of it stuck with me. Tried in intensive Polish classes. It was one of the most humbling experiences in my life. Trying one of them free apps now, learning Spanish. or studying Spanish. Learning is a strong word. What's your story? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And Anna is going to start us off in Stevens Point. Anna, hi. Thanks for calling. What's your story?
Hi, I'm Anna Kukova. I own a business called checktalk.com. And I live here in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. I teach all online group and private Czech lessons.
It's called Czech Talk, like the Czech language.
Yeah, C-Z-E-C-H-T-A-L-K.
Okay. Now, is this for English speakers? How hard is Czech learn? I did Polish, another Slavic language.
It's very similar to Polish.
I had a hard time.
I grew up in the Czech Republic, about 8 kilometers from the Polish border. And it's very easy to learn to read. You can learn to read in an hour and a half to 2 hours, a phrase book or a dictionary.
And there's a lot of good reading out there in Czech. There's a lot of great Czech authors to read.
Very good Czech authors. And a lot of history books that have not been translated into English that just really shed a big light on the history of the Czech lands going way back into 600, 900.
Fantastic, Anna. And do people tend to pick it up pretty quick when they're learning it? The reading, you said, at least?
Most of my students are retired with Czech ancestry. Some are planning to be foreign exchange students going to the Czech Republic, or are married to Czech spouses and want to be able to communicate with in-laws. So a lot of the students take classes for several years.
And can you leave us with a sign-off, Anna, in Czech? Keep it clean, because we don't know how to check it for FCC purposes.
Drazí přátelé, jsem ráda, že jsem mohla být mezi vámi. Dear friends, I was so glad to be among you.
We're glad you're among us. Anna, thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. Looking at your stories of learning another language. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go now to Elizabeth with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I grew up, my first language was a type of German dialect, more Austrian. My mother's parents were from Austria, and my father was born in Hungary and then later moved to Germany. And so I really miss speaking the language. Just lost my father to COVID last year. Oh. And he knew Hungarian, English, and German. And
wow.
It was really fun to hear him speak in all three of those languages.
Do you remember, at what age did you learn English at, Elizabeth?
Well, I think I must have started learning in kindergarten. My mom knew English, but obviously both of them spoke with each other in the dialect. So maybe kindergarten? I really don't know.
And I hear it's easier to learn at that younger age. Did it come easy to you?
It is. It is much easier to learn it. Between 0 and 3, actually, your language development is really, that's the best time to learn. So, yeah.
Elizabeth, I'm sorry for the loss of your dad. Do you find opportunities still to speak German?
You know, once in a while, my sisters and I will speak with each other if we don't want our adult children to know what we're saying.
My grandparents used to do that to me in Polish. I love it. Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, I appreciate that story at 800-642-1234. Getting your stories of learning another language or a third or fourth language, whatever it might be, or trying and struggling with it as some of us do. 800-642-1234 is the number. Karen joins us next in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi. So I remember in school we did we have Spanish where you'd learn a few words like profesora and the colors, in elementary school. And then in sixth grade, my class was the guinea pig group. They decided to see what happens if they actually try and teach foreign language to children in America. And so they set us up for German. And so we had that in sixth grade and as an option in seventh grade. They hadn't planned for eighth grade, so they ended up having to get the German teacher up before school to come teach an early bird course for those of us who wanted to continue until we could get into high school. And I've continued learning languages. I'm reasonably fluent in German and Spanish, studied other languages, some French, Portuguese, Dutch, Russian, a little bit of Italian, a little Danish.
Do you find, Karen, that learning more languages gets easier the more you have under your belt?
Yes. It is easier, but I find that there's kind of a threshold that you need to reach before it makes sense if you really want to be serious about learning another language. I think of it as like having boxes. I have my English box, and I have my Spanish box, and I have my German box, and then I have the box of all the other languages that I've been trying to learn but haven't gotten good enough yet to give their own boxes to.
Well, now there's my problem, because I keep reaching to the wrong box. I was never as good at remembering German words as when I was taking a Polish class. Then all of a sudden, the German came flooding back when I didn't need it anymore. Does that ever happen to you?
Oh, yeah. I try speaking Dutch and end up speaking Portuguese and vice versa. And so any of the languages that I haven't become incredibly fluent in,
that's
what happens. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Karen. I do have some measure of envy for you speaking all those languages. Time for another caller. Yeah, Dory is with us in Madison. Hi, Dory.
Hi. I first started learning Norwegian when I was a child because my dad did a sabbatical in Norway. Completely forgot my Norwegian, but I learned French and Spanish later, and I'm fluent in both French and Spanish. And I have also taught Spanish to young children. And I'd like to say, first of all, if you don't have a lot of experience in language, I recommend learning an easy language first, not Polish or, I hesitate to say it, Czech, but either French, Spanish, or a Scandinavian language, which are the easiest for English speakers to learn.
Interesting. That's all the time we have, Dory. Thanks for leaving us that recommendation. Keep sharing your language stories. Email ideas@WPR.org. Tomorrow on Central Time, the U.S. has a new infrastructure spending bill in place. We'll find out what it could mean for roads, bridges, broadband, and more here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an investigative reporter shares an inside look at the mismanagement, greed, and other factors that led to bankruptcy and lawsuits at the National Rifle Association and why the story isn't going away anytime soon. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. The National Rifle Association was accused last week in a federal lawsuit of violating campaign finance laws and contributing millions of dollars to various Republican political campaigns, among them former President Donald Trump and Senator Ron Johnson. A gun control nonprofit called Giffords, founded by former Democratic Representative Gabby Giffords, who was seriously injured in a deadly mass shooting in 2011, is behind that lawsuit. The suit is just the latest in a long string of problems facing the NRA, including investigations into financial mismanagement and a long-running internal dispute centering around the leader of the organization, Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre. Our next guest has been following that story for years and shares it in a new book out this month. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts or questions about the NRA? Are you a member? Have you ever been a member? What do you think about how it's changed over the years? Are you concerned about the financial mismanagement that has been brought up in lawsuits and by members and former members of the organization? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tim Mack is a Washington investigative correspondent for NPR. His new book, just released last week, is called Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start with a central character in this book, Wayne LaPierre, for people who follow the gun debate, a central figure, the face of the NRA in many ways. Can you talk about a little bit about his rise to this key leadership role in the NRA?
Yeah, so Wayne LaPierre is the executive vice president and has long been the CEO of the National Rifle Association, and he's served in that role since the early 90s. Now, in a lot of ways, the NRA is in the financial and legal turmoil that it's in today because of some of Wayne LaPierre's personality traits. You know, the book opens with this scene in the late 90s, and we're at Wayne LaPierre's wedding, and he doesn't want to get married. And so the ceremony's start times comes and goes, and he's outside with his best man, who also doesn't think he should get married that day. And the best man puts a $100 bill on the dashboard of the car and says, you know, we could just get out of here. But Wayne LaPierre goes in. He's ultimately almost kind of harangued into the ceremony by his bride and the priest. And ultimately, there's this weird ceremony that goes forward where he can't even make eye contact with the bride, but does get married that day. There's a reason I tell that anecdote, because despite, you know, his public persona as a kind of strong, iron-willed Second Amendment defender, Wayne LaPierre, in private, longtime associates describe him as a kind of weak-willed and almost cowardly figure. And I think a lot of people in the NRA, powerful figures in and around the NRA, have realized over time that Wayne LaPierre, if you push him hard enough, yell at him long enough, he'll eventually greenlight millions of dollars in sweetheart contract deals for NRA vendors or golden parachutes for former executives. A lot of the reasons why the NRA finds itself in the troubles it does today is because of Wayne LaPierre's character.
The NRA is well known for its membership and supporters who might make small donations regularly to the NRA and be willing to make phone calls to members of Congress, for its lobbying apparatus that goes and meets with members of Congress and state legislatures. Less well known until recently is what's happening at the higher level. A lot of big spending and very questionable, according to some members and now to outside investigators, very questionable financial arrangements. Can you take us into that world? What kind of things are we seeing?
We're talking about millions of dollars in private jets, lavish meals, trips to the Bahamas and to Lake Como in Italy. We're talking about six figures in Italian menswear and suits for Wayne LaPierre from a boutique on Rodeo Drive in Los Angeles. The New York Attorney General launched an investigation in 2019 and concluded in 2020 that the NRA had misspent tens of millions of dollars, more than $60 million in just a few short years, naming Wayne LaPierre and other top NRA officials as part of a lawsuit to dissolve the NRA completely. They're arguing, the New York Attorney General is arguing, that the NRA is so corrupt from top to bottom that it shouldn't be allowed to exist as a nonprofit, which is what it is right now.
You heard from a lot of people who had been in the organization, often in key roles, who agreed with that assessment, who are trying to sound the alarm saying, let's clean our house before somebody comes in and cleans it for us. What kind of things did you hear from NRA insiders?
Well, you know, this book really is trying to pull the curtain back and show the personalities, the conflicts behind the scenes. And I was able to do that by doing more than 120 interviews with folks inside the NRA universe, and also obtained thousands of pages worth of secret depositions and internal NRA emails and private documents to paint this portrait of what happened. There are a lot of people who spoke to me because they were just horrified by what they see as the direction of the National Rifle Association, which they support. And the NRA, you know, has for a long time depended on low dollar donors and grassroots membership. And I know that a lot of people who ended up being sources for me and explaining what happened inside the organization did so because they were thinking of these folks in America who are members, often blue collar workers, sending in $5, $10, $15 a month to an organization and it going towards these lavish meals and expenses and so on and so forth, that obviously the folks who are contributing money weren't intending them to be.
Talking to Tim Mack, NPR correspondent, author of the new book just out last week, Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. One of the key figures you look at is Oliver North, the former Marine colonel, center of the 1980s Iran-Contra scandal. He becomes president of the NRA, which you describe, I think most people agree, as largely a ceremonial and fundraising role. He takes it more seriously. What starts to happen?
So in 2018, just to set the scene, things are so bad at the NRA financially that they almost don't make payroll. I mean, obviously, that's a serious problem for any organization to be in. And Oliver North gets recruited by Wayne LaPierre to be the president, as you say. It's kind of a figurehead role. Wayne LaPierre is hoping that Oliver North will use his celebrity to fundraise the NRA out of their financial woes. The problem is that Oliver North, when he shows up, he starts to wonder where all this money he's fundraising ends up going. He demands an internal audit of some of the finances in the NRA, and he's met with real great resistance from Wayne LaPierre and other top executives. And this kind of culminates in this climactic scene in Misfire, where Wayne LaPierre and Oliver North confront each other in an Indianapolis hotel suite just days before their annual convention, when Mike Pence and Donald Trump are expected to speak. Ultimately, Wayne LaPierre pushes Oliver North out of the presidency of the National Rifle Association before that internal audit can be done.
I want to check out kind of a side story in some ways to the narrative, but it plays in some key ways, the Russian connections. Maria Butina, who worked in some ways with Russian intelligence people or people connected to Russian intelligence, using the NRA to try to make contact with prominent Republican officials. Can you share the NRA's role in that story?
Sure. So Maria Butina was a Russian citizen who shows up in the United States, and in particular in Washington, D.C., where I live. And she starts causing a stir in political circles in D.C. Particularly, she's introducing herself to different people in different ways. She says she's a Russian government official or a journalist or a small business owner, an interpreter, a Second Amendment, a gun rights activist. And it really raises a lot of questions about what she's doing. And so I start writing about her in 2017. She spent a lot of time networking with NRA officials and actually ends up playing the NRA. The NRA spends thousands of dollars paying for her trips and travel and networking. Ultimately, she is charged and arrested for being an unregistered government agent of Russia. And she's convicted ultimately, spends some time in prison, and gets deported. And it's really an interesting example of how the NRA got played and how it was so disorganized and so freely willing to spend money on things outside of the obvious realm of what their members would want.
We're talking to NPR Washington investigative correspondent Tim Mack about his new book, Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a member or supporter of the NRA? Are you worried about the management of the National Rifle Association, the way it spends its money? Do you think it's lost sight of its mission? Are you a critic or opponent of the NRA? What do you think of the stories we're hearing here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Tim Mack about his new book, Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Tim's a Washington investigative correspondent for NPR. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about the NRA, what you hope to see happen with the organization in the future. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my sort of questions last comment, earlier this year, I listened to a different NPR show, Radiolab, and their series More Perfect, about the Constitution and how that sort of has been interpreted over the years and how that's changed so much. Specifically, they talked a lot about the Second Amendment. And the NRA, and the fact that the sort of modern interpretation of the Second Amendment, the sort of idea that Americans have a right to own whatever guns, and as the NRA would like, you know, without any restrictions, that interpretation of the Second Amendment has only really come about in the last 20 or 30 years, and really as strongly pushed by the NRA.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. And Tim, you write about the NRA as recently as what, the mid to late 60s, I think, supporting gun control laws in states and nationwide. What led to the change that Michael's talking about?
Well, you know, the NRA traditionally, for most of the 20th century, had been focused on gun safety and shooting sports. It's really only in the late 70s where the NRA begins its kind of evolution into a much more politically active group. in the late 70s, the NRA was actually thinking about leaving Washington, D.C., and getting out of, well, maybe not entirely getting out of, but distancing itself from political advocacy and moving to Colorado as kind of emphasize their interest in shooting sports. But the members of the NRA ended up revolting on the convention floor in 1977 and kicking out a lot of executives from the organization, as well as kind of reshaping it into the politically active advocacy group that it is today. I mean, there are a lot of different other turning points for the NRA, but that's certainly one of the most cited. Another one is what happened after Sandy Hook. The NRA made a strategic decision after Sandy Hook internally to stop reaching out to Democrats and doubling down on just reaching out to conservatives and Republicans and using a culture war approach to increasing fundraising and membership. They found that it was very successful to kind of position the NRA not just as a gun rights group, but also as a kind of quote unquote freedom organization that was standing between the government and their members' rights.
Thanks for the call, Michael, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Keith in Madison. Keith, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Keith?
First of all, I want to thank your guests for coming on. It's nice to, you know, get a lot of different views. I'm a, I guess you'd say an ex-longtime NRA. I'm a member of a couple of different other advocacy groups these days. I do agree with pretty much everything your guest has been talking about so far. So no disagreements from somebody who's been around it for a pretty long time. I've got a little bit of a different observation. I wonder if you'd care to comment. I think that one of the reasons that LaPierre was able to remain a dynasty, if you will, is because the NRA's board of directors is huge by other organizations' standards. It's, you might know better than me these days, but there are at least 25, probably pushing 50, people on the board of directors. They delegate to a much smaller executive committee, handpicked by LaPierre, and that's who actually runs the organization. And that's why it's so damn difficult to make any changes to the organization while LaPierre is in power.
Keith, thanks for the call. Tim, can you talk about the role of that board? I think people in you or someone in the book compared it to the Politburo, large but ineffectual in some ways.
And unwieldy. And your caller is in the right direction, but it's even larger than he suggested. It's 76 members on this board. And if you look at the resumes of a lot of folks on that board, they don't have the kinds of backgrounds that you'd expect. Boards are usually meant for oversight and accountability purposes. And if you look at the experience of folks on that board, you don't see accountants and lawyers and people who are financial professionals. You see a lot of firearms activists not a lot of people who are qualified to oversee an organization which, if it were publicly traded, would be an enormous organization. I mean, the NRA takes in hundreds of millions of dollars a year. In 2016, more than $400 million. So it's an enormous organization.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Tim Mack about his brand new book. It's called Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. And I hit downfall hard there, Tim. Dire straits financially, the organization facing a lot of lawsuits, including new ones just in the last week or so. But does that mean the NRA is on the way out in some way? Is this really the beginning of the end, do you think?
It's a very serious possibility. I mean, right now, the New York Attorney General, which has jurisdiction over the NRA, the New York Attorney General has filed a lawsuit asking a court to dissolve the NRA completely. That office has conducted an investigation and found tens of millions of dollars of inappropriate spending from just the last few years within the National Rifle Association. And so there's a serious possibility that the NRA, through this process, could get broken up or dissolved. While I don't know if that's the most likely option, there are definitely signs that NRA members have been very, very deeply concerned about, that their organization might not exist in a year or two.
The NRA tried to get out ahead of that in some ways by filing for bankruptcy in 2021. What did they claim? What were they seeking to change?
Well, basically, after the New York Attorney General launched its litigation, the National Rifle Association tried to use bankruptcy law and the protections of bankruptcy law, which usually allow an organization in dire financial straits to reorganize. And so they tried to use that law to move out of New York into Texas, outside the jurisdiction of the New York Attorney General. Now, a bankruptcy judge found that that was not a filing done in good faith and rejected that attempt for bankruptcy and the move to Texas. And now the NRA is back right where it started, which is facing a very serious threat from the New York Attorney General.
Now, a new lawsuit I mentioned at the top of our conversation about campaign finance, potential alleged campaign finance violations. What's going on there?
Well, it's a very serious allegation. And you'll remember that in 2016, the NRA spent more than $30 million to support the Trump campaign. In fact, more even than the Trump super PAC spent to support his election. In the years since, the NRA's political spending has waned because they've had serious, serious financial troubles. I'll be watching very closely to see what happens with this litigation.
You also mentioned that for a lot of years, the NRA was the elephant in the room on gun issues, and there wasn't any equivalent in terms of influence and certainly of money for a lot of decades. Has that been changing?
When it comes to the gun, on their side of the conversation, there's really no other game in town. The NRA is larger than any other group of its kind and it's not really seriously challenged when it comes to financial prowess and political power. On the gun safety side, on the gun control side of the conversation, though, there's been a steadily emerging movement to push back against the NRA. It's especially grown since the Sandy Hook tragedy. In 2018, the gun safety movement, for the first time, outspent the gun rights movement. And that's a real interesting milestone as we kind of look at the future of what gun politics is going to be like in America.
In a world without the NRA, do you think that the community that supports the NRA, the Second Amendment supporters, the gun owners around the United States, would still be a potent political force?
I think that, because the NRA is under such threat right now, it's not impossible to imagine a world without the NRA. The thing is that even in that world, its 4.9 million members will still be there, still with their own views and still providing an implicit threat to lawmakers who might push against their political agenda. So I think what's true is that while the organization is in real trouble, its membership still represents a very potent force in American politics.
In just our last few moments, Wayne LaPierre, where is he now?
He remains still at the head of the NRA. He's been there since the early, as the head of the organization since the early 90s. And he's still plugging along despite all of these allegations of misconduct and all the evidence that has come out in the courts. But the real question is, will he still be there a year from now? And what will be the outcome of the litigation first brought by the New York Attorney General?
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Tim Mak is a Washington investigative correspondent for NPR. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA.